Gar and I, as you know, as we sit here together and talk about this, we understand accountability, and we are accountable for what this team did this year. We don't run away from it. We accept it. That's on us.
Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA, your number one source for Chicago Bulls news and stories.
For me to be here in the NBA organization, such a historic organization, the Chicago Bulls, so it's just a dream come true for me.
Live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
This is going to be a process. You'll snap your fingers and it all happens at once, but that's the plan moving forward.
So kick back, relax, and get ready for the best hour of your day. Locked On Bulls starts now. Here are your hosts, Jordan Malley and Matt Peck.
What's up and welcome into Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. We're live on Dash Radio, dashradio.com, and the Dash Radio app. On the Nothing But Net channel, we're live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time. I'm your host, Jordan Malley, writer of Bulls basketball and the NBA at FanRag Sports and College Hoops over at SB Nation. Along with me is Matt Peck, writer of Bulls basketball and the NBA at FanRag Sports and the host of the 312 show on AM 1590 WCGO. Follow us on social media on Twitter at Jordan C. Malley, at Bulls underscore Peck, and at Locked On Bulls. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/LockedOnShyBulls, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and anywhere you find podcasts, you will find us. 331-979-1369 is the line to text and call. Remember, we're doing mailbag every week, so we're going to probably do that on Wednesday. So if you want to send us a voicemail, you got questions, anything you guys want to talk about, send it to us at 331-979-1369. Welcome back, Bulls Nation. Good to be back. Obviously, for the people that might have listened to Friday's show when I said that you were sorry if you weren't going to watch the NBA Finals, I think this was game two was the argument for those fans that said, yeah, I don't want any part of this, because you went out there and everything that went from game one, the stipulations with J.R. Smith and George Hill and all the storylines that went from game one, I thought was unsettling a little bit yesterday when we watched that game and Steph Curry came out and just lit the place on fire in the second half. But I can see the argument now why there were some fans out there that did not want to see this matchup again, and rightfully so in game two, which it turned out to be pretty much a no-brainer blowout for the Warriors.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a blowout. The final score, 122-103. I think, like, the Cavs were in that game until probably, I don't know, I guess the middle of the fourth quarter, where the Warriors, Steve Kerr took an early timeout in the fourth, and I thought that timeout really decided the game, because that's when the Cavs were still hanging around. They were only down like 8 or 10, and the Warriors went on one of their crazy only the Warriors can do this runs, where all of a sudden a 10-point lead ballooned to a 20-point lead in what felt like a matter of seconds, and that was the game right there. I think LeBron, for the insane standards we set for him, had a fairly pedestrian night. 29 points on 10 of 20 shooting, to go with 13 assists and 9 rebounds. He did have 5 turnovers. The turnovers have been the thing that have really plagued LeBron, if anything has plagued LeBron in these playoffs, and it's mostly just because he's being asked to do so much and handle the ball so much. Obviously, like, game one was the opportunity for the Cavs, I think, to steal this and make this more of a series than people believed it would be. That being said, Cleveland has won their last 8 games at home, and we know that the Warriors can be lazy at times, can be careless at times. A lot of people are saying that the Warriors took the Cavs' best punch in game one because LeBron put up 50, but I would not be surprised at all to see the Cavs win one or maybe even both of these home games. I think the more likely scenario is that the Cavs find a way to win one of these games, the Warriors win the other, and the Warriors close it out in game five. But I'm not convinced that that is the only possible outcome now that the series shifts back to Cleveland.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it's not completely over until we at least see Golden State win one on the road. If they come out and win game three, I think you could pretty much seal the deal. It would just be a matter of whether Golden State wants to win it on their home floor, sweep the Cavs in four. So I'm not ready to count them out yet. I still think LeBron's got a few tricks left and a little bit of juice left in the tank. but they're going to need more out of J.R. Smith. Obviously, they're going to need more out of George Hill as well. Guys need to start stepping up, and you got to find a way to contain Steph Curry. Obviously, he was on two in game two, setting an all-time record for three-pointers. I think at halftime, he was at 6 for 18, and then ended up going on and setting the record for all-time three-pointers in the NBA Finals, going 9 for 17, finishing with 33 points. Another point real quick about this game, too, and I found a nice adjustment by Steve Kerr, and one that I think a lot of people shocked a lot of people, was inserting JaVale McGee into the starting lineup in game two. I think they saw what LeBron was doing early on in game one, where he was driving to the basket, getting a lot of fouls drawn. They couldn't contain him around the bucket. And I think they did a good job of inserting JaVale McGee there. He was 6 for 6, 2 on the offensive side of the ball for 12 points. But I thought just having a guy around the rim to protect and be able to stop LeBron at times, I think put a big, I would say put a big roadblock in what LeBron was maybe going to try to do in this game too. And I thought it was a really nice adjustment by Steve Kerr.
Yeah, I think it surprised a lot of people, because you and I were joking about JaVale McGee's minutes from game one. And he was a factor in game one for the small amount of minutes he got. And even though he was inserted into the starting lineup, he still only played 18 minutes in game two. And as you said, 6 for 6, 5 of those were dunks. JaVale McGee, he can't do a lot, but he can do that. I feel like Steve Kerr played a little bit of chess there. I wouldn't be surprised to see him go back to starting Kevon Looney, or maybe even giving Jordan Bell a start. We'll see what Ty Lue does, if Ty Lue makes any adjustments to his starting lineup, because you mentioned J.R. Smith. After the debacle of game one, he followed it up with a dud in game two, 2 for 9, 5 points. A lot of people are talking about whether or not Ty Lue should just bench J.R. Smith at this point and give his minutes to somebody else. Kyle Korver only played 17 minutes in game two, which to me is surprising. Larry Nance Jr. had looked like a player who was useful at times through the first two games of this series, after a lot of people declared him to be dead and useless. Rodney Hood, the guy that they got in that trade from Utah, and was averaging 17 points earlier this season, and has just disappeared for the Cavs in these playoffs. Maybe Ty Lue looks to give him a chance, because right now anything is better than what J.R. Smith has given them through two games.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And I was going to say, too, it's tough to look at the Cavs bench and decide, okay, if you're going to bench J.R. Smith, who do you go to? Rodney Hood has played what? The number of minutes he's played in this playoff, you could probably count on your fingers. And I looked at Jordan Clarkson for the 8 minutes he was in, especially early on in that first half. That guy's terrible. He stinks. And
he has never met a shot he doesn't love.
Seriously, man. Every time I watched him get the ball, I looked at my roommates and I said, he's going to shoot it. Like, there's no doubt in my mind he's going to try to make something happen. And this isn't the time to do that, Jordan Clarkson. So I don't know if they go to him or they go to Rodney Hood. I don't know how much left Kyle Korver has in him either to stay with the same pace as the Warriors. That's like another thing to completely think about, is how many of these guys can stay with the same pace as the Warriors are playing on the defensive side of the ball too. You're talking about the offensive side of the troubles for the Cavaliers, but then you have a completely other problem in stopping, containing Kevin Durant, Klay Thompson, and Steph Curry. So I don't know. At this point, it's going to have to be all or nothing on LeBron, and maybe get a little bit extra out of Kevin Love. But J.R. Smith, I mean, if he does play in this game three, he's got to do something. And same thing with George Hill. I mean, a combined 7 for 21 from both of those guys and only 20 points, that's not going to cut it.
Yeah, I mean, George Hill had a pedestrian game two, and in the games that Cleveland has won in their march all the way to the finals in this postseason, when George Hill plays well and has a big game, they tend to win. So I don't think you're taking him out or you're adjusting his minutes in any way. You're just hoping that he has a better game. And I know I just said that maybe the best option Ty Lue has now is benching J.R. Smith. Then you run the risk of missing out on the potential good version of J.R. Smith, which usually happens at home, where, yeah, he's one of the streakiest shooters in the league, but J.R. Smith can have those games where he is the good version of a streaky shooter and put up like somewhere between 20 and 30 points. So, I mean, as bad as he's played, and Ty Lue and all of his teammates have come out since game one and even after a bad game two and said, we still believe in J.R. Smith. We still, you know, we need him. We need his production. I don't think that they're going to take him out of the starting lineup. I think they're going to hope that good J.R. shows back up for these games at Cleveland, for these games in Cleveland, where not just J.R., but most of these role players and George Hill included, they play better at home, like most role players do. So if they can get a Herculean effort from LeBron like they got in game one and the role players step up, and simultaneously the Warriors are saying, all right, well, we're up 2-0. We could take their foot off the gas a little bit. The Cavs can win game three. They just need everybody to play well, and they need the Warriors to play meh. That's the formula for the Cavs to win at even a game in this series.
Yeah, I like your idea of maybe going to desperation mode in game four if J.R. Smith has another dud of a game at home and they're down 3-0. At that point, you're just like, all right, let's see what we can do. Rodney Hood get out there for a few more minutes than maybe he's been playing. But at that point, it's just like it's desperation mode. I feel like down 3-0, LeBron's probably thinking, all right, let's win one game. I don't want to get swept out of the playoffs. Or at the same time, LeBron could be like, screw this, I'm checked out, it's over.
Yeah, LeBron, if they go down 3-0, LeBron might just check out and start thinking about where he's, you know, where he's going to be playing next season as he's, you know, just sort of sleepwalking his way through game four. Because that's the other thing, and that's something that people are talking about, is when LeBron in game two kind of has that not full speed ahead, I'm a freight train, nothing can stop me mentality, and it's just sort of the regular human version of LeBron, that mentality and that emotion and that state of mind just kind of seeps down into the rest of his guys because they follow his lead. He is, by and large, the leader of that team. And when LeBron is locked in and doing insane LeBron things, that motivates those guys to step up and step up their games and play better. When LeBron checks himself out of the games mentally, his teammates check out too.
It's a good point. And you think about that in the way that LeBron sort of asks of his teammates, the things that he asks of his teammates. And I think at times you look at other players that have played with LeBron and have won and also have lost and struggled with LeBron. Somebody brought up the point that maybe this team is just sick and tired of being told that they're terrible. And everybody's point, to our point, saying that they're bad. Yeah, they're bad because they're not performing, but the expectations that LeBron has of teammates, I think, can be in a correlation of things like Kyrie Irving being sick of being part of the Cavaliers, and maybe some of these other players are just sick and tired of playing with LeBron and being under all this scrutiny, and maybe that has a negative effect to some point for some of these players on this Cavaliers team. I'm interested to see what happens when they go home. I still don't think, I'm not ready to count LeBron out completely yet, just especially because of the game that happened in game one, and then there was kind of a flash in the pan what we sort of expected in game two. So I'm interested to see going back home, seeing if that home crowd can help them push to a 2-1 Golden State lead going into game four. But it'll be interesting. What were your thoughts real quick on the officiating in game two and Kevin Love not being suspended and Tristan Thompson getting the $25,000 fine? Draymond Green also making comments after game one saying that he didn't want Tristan Thompson to be suspended. All of this stuff that had come out about game one and the officiating, do you think it went a little bit better in game two or just about the same?
I mean, it was a mixed bag in game two, whereas I think there were a lot of very debatable calls that were made, and you and I talked about a few of them in our episode on Friday. Like, there weren't any big, oh my God, I can't believe they made that call moments, and I think partly it's because by the time that you get to worry about those calls that can affect a game, the game was already over, right? It's the last 2 minute report notes about whether officials made the right call or the wrong call that really get fans all rustled and gets everybody all rustled. But because the Warriors were up big for the majority of the fourth quarter, none of the questionable calls really stick in your mind. There may have been some throughout the first three quarters of the game, but the officiating did not decide the game in game two. 100%, you cannot claim that the officiating decided the game, whereas some might claim that the officiating had a heavy hand in determining the outcome of game one.
I'm with you. I think the only call that really sticks out in my head and sort of was a turning point in the first half of this game, weird call, the non-foul call on Steph Curry at a three-pointer, and then they said the ball was tipped off of LeBron, and so they gave the Warriors the ball. The Warriors ended up going, like, I think, on a 9-0 run in 2.5 minutes after that happened. The Cavaliers Lakers were only down four at that point. I think that was the only kind of like head scratching. Okay, he missed a foul call, so he gave it back to the Warriors because it should have been their ball anyway. I think that was the only call that I was kind of scratching my head at. And you could see LeBron reacted the same way. He was like, how are you going to call that a tipped ball even though you didn't make a foul call there? Like, you're just, at that point, it looked like he thought they were making up for a call. And it did lead to a Warriors run. But like you said, I think the officiating was way better in game two than game one.
But yeah, so that was a questionable call, but the refs didn't go on a 9-0 run to put the Cavs in a hole.
You're right.
The Warriors did. So, but to your other point about the whole scuffle from game one, I'm glad that they didn't suspend Tristan Thompson, and you want to slap him with a fine, that's fine with me. And I'm glad that they didn't suspend Kevin Love for what I think is a pretty dumb rule about being on the court when you're not actively in the game. So, I'm glad. I thought it was, you know, and I said that on Friday, it would have been dumb and it would have made the finals less entertaining and taken away from the drama and taken away from that palpable friction and tension between these two teams that have faced each other for the fourth time now and clearly don't like each other. Just, you know, it was a tiny moment in game one where people got a little hot-headed. We move on. You want to give a fine to the guy who kind of threw a punch. Okay, fine. Well, and I think they said technically the fine was for not leaving the court in a timely manner.
Before he could throw the ball.
Because, you know, he didn't leave the court right away because he had to throw a ball to Draymond's face and then kind of punch him a little bit. But still, in my opinion, not deserving of a suspension for Tristan or Kevin.
Oh, that's too funny. All right, we got to take a short break. But when we come back, we've got tons of Bulls stuff to talk about. Obviously, Mohamed Bamba meeting and working out for the Bulls on Friday. Want to touch on some notes there. And also a very interesting article talking about who the Bulls might be looking at to draft. Some unexpected names have popped up in an unexpected position maybe that has popped up. So stay right here with us at Locked On Bulls. Be back in 60 seconds.
It's night and day from my time, from when I left Texas to now. My mechanics are a lot smoother, you know, my makes all net and my misses are landing a lot softer, and, you know, I've improved a lot. I mean, when you look at all the categories that, you know, they struggled in, those are all things that I can step in and help, you know, impact immediately. You know, they were, I think, either last or second in block shots, and I like to think of myself as a pretty good shot blocker. You know, I can just step in immediately and have an impact for this team. I solely think Chicago is one of the better fits for me than other places, and that's why I thought it was important to come work out. But my assessment is they have a lot of talent in a lot of different areas, and this is a team for the future. I mean, it's a really young team. I think the oldest guy on the team is Robin, and I'm not sure exactly how old he is, but, you know, he's not exactly the oldest guy. It's a pretty young team, and I'm looking forward to really get to know these guys.
So that was the voice of Mo Bamba. He met with the Bulls media on Friday, leaving open for questions just kind of how he felt things have gone and whether or not he feels like he's a fit with the Bulls, could potentially be a pick at number 7. I know we've talked back and forth, Matt, whether Dallas might be selecting him. He might be going before the Bulls, but it was honestly sort of eye-opening for me, at least somebody who watched college basketball, especially Texas, at like a 10,000 foot radius, not really that close to it. I was very surprised by how media ready, and I think that was something across the board, people who were there speaking with him on Friday said, media ready, very humble kid, a kid who can speak well for himself, thinks highly of his game, and is a determined worker. So all of those things added up to positives and things that we've already added onto his game that we liked about him. But honestly, it gets my hopes up in bad ways because I really just don't think Mohamed Bamba is going to be there at 7 for the Bulls.
Yeah, I think that's the disappointing thing about getting that player into the Bulls facilities for a workout and some interviews, because I, like you, was impressed with everything I saw and heard from Mo Bamba. I think that guy is going to be a stud in the NBA. And like you, I think, especially with what we've heard over the last week or 2 weeks, that this, you know, one or maybe two different scenarios that could hypothetically play out to have Bamba fall into the Bulls' lap at 7 just seem less and less likely to happen. I think that he will be taken by Dallas if he's not in the top 4 And if, heck, I mean, I know that the Orlando, everybody's talking about Orlando being high on Trae Young because they need a point guard. And, you know, they took Jonathan Isaac last year. But, I mean, heck, maybe everybody's raving about Mo Bamba so much and Orlando takes Mo Bamba. I'm trying, like you, to not get my hopes up about Mo Bamba because I just don't think he's going to be there at seven, which is too bad because everything that we heard from him on Friday, he thinks that the Bulls would be a great fit for him and he'd be a great fit for the Bulls playing in that front court along with Lauri Markkanen. So he seems like a very bright young kid, seems like a kid with a great NBA future ahead of him. And it's just kind of a little bit of a tease to get him into Chicago, get him at the Bulls facilities, and all of a sudden, well, that was a fun day. Remember that day when we all thought we were going to get Mo Bamba? Yeah, well, it was only that day.
Well, I like the fact that he brought up playing alongside Lauri Markkanen. I think this has been a common theme among guys that would potentially play with him along the front court. Anytime anybody's asked, they always point to Lauri Markkanen, which is a good thing. That's a good thing to have when prospects are looking at teams and potentially where they're being drafted, and they look at pieces on their team and how they would fit in right away. And I think that's something Mohamed Bamba had brought up. He said, I feel like I could have an impact right away with this team alongside Lauri Markkanen, open things up for him as well. So I'm a little disappointed too. It's kind of all for nothing, and maybe there is a change, and who knows that what could happen over the next 3 weeks until the draft leads up. But if I had to place my bets right now, I don't think he's going to be available there. But hey, crazier things have happened. So let's get to the other news from out of Bulls camp that I think has surprised, at least surprised me a little bit. I don't know about you, Matt, but a report from Vincent Goodwill of NBC Sports Chicago said that the Bulls are extremely high on Trae Young and Colin Sexton, and it's not out of the realm of possibility that they could draft a point guard at number seven. What were your initial thoughts when you saw this yesterday?
I clenched a little bit. I'm not going to lie. I mean, in his report, Goodwill uses the word enamored when describing how the Bulls feel about Trae Young, and said also high on Colin Sexton, Paul Zipser,
who were high on.
So, yeah, I mean, I say I clench a little bit because as you and I have discussed recently, for all the hype around Trae Young, and we heard from him at his NBA Pro Day, I don't see the Steph Curry. Yes, the kid can shoot, and he's also pretty decent breaking down defenses and finding looks for his teammates. He's a talented passer. I think people overlook his passing skills just because he has that crazy three ball mojo that that is getting that Steph Curry comparison kind of attention. He talked at his pro day whatever about his defensive work that he's doing, getting ready for his rookie season and trying to fight through screens. And he said he's added 10 pounds since the end of Oklahoma's season, 10 pounds of muscle to try to bulk up that small frame of his. So, I mean, clearly the kid's trying to address what people can readily see as the weaknesses in his game. But the fact that we got this report that the Bulls are really enamored with Trae Young and also really like Colin Sexton and wouldn't let the fact that they already have Chris Dunn on their roster prevent them from drafting either of those kids if they decide that they are the best player available at seven, to me, it's just, I'm not convinced. I don't know about you, Jordan. I worry that the Bulls are going to take Trae Young at seven because, as I've said before, I have my doubts about how he will translate at the NBA level.
Hey, look, I've said it a couple times now, and I think if there is now a more realistic possibility that Trae Young could be a Chicago Bull in 3 weeks, we have to at least discuss his game and what this impact could be on this Bulls team. I've tried to play it off long enough for us to where we could maybe not even think about the idea that maybe Orlando was going to take him before, and I'm still there. I still want Orlando to take him at number six, so the Bulls don't even have an idea of taking Trae Young. But with that being said, enamored's a pretty big word. Let's see synonyms for enamored: loving, crazy about, nuts about, silly about, stuck on, entranced, charmed, enchanted, fascinated, and captivated. So using that kind of words with Trae Young.
I clenched harder every word that you just spit out there. Good Lord.
Oh, man. So not only him, but I thought it was interesting that they said that about Colin Sexton as well. And Colin Sexton's kind of, for me, the wild card here, because his name, I don't think, has been brought up as much as some other prospects have who drove up the board, especially between picks like 8 and 14, staying in that lottery. I think his name coming up is also interesting to me, too. So let's take, for example, that Trey Young is in the mix and certainly is now at this point. I went back on Sunday and had to watch some of his film and wanted to see exactly where his weaknesses were and also some of the strengths and things that could play off to the Bulls positively. So here's a couple things that I came up with, Matt, and I want you to make some comments here on whether or not you see a fit with the Bulls or not, or if this is going to be a struggle for Trey Young's game. So obviously the first one is he's got an unworldly ability to hit shots from anywhere on the floor. If you watch the film, he is the quickest release, I think, in college basketball, if not one of the quickest releases in college basketball, and he's fearless with where he's taking his shots, and I think the confidence builds there. So that one was obvious. I was particularly impressed with his isolation play at times. I think he's got the ability to create his own shot. His ball handling skills are great. His passing ability, and when he knows shots aren't going down, his ability to rack up 10 plus assists on Oklahoma's team, who offensively outside of Trae Young wasn't that great, I thought that was great. His vision is fantastic. His ability to do things, like I said, when his shot isn't falling, I think was particularly impressive for a guy his size. So now there's a couple weaknesses, too, I want to throw out at you. Physical tools are obviously something that he's talked about multiple times that he needs to improve on. He wants to get bigger and be able to withstand having to guard somebody or driving to the basket and being able to take hits and take bodies over and over again in the NBA. And I think that's going to be one of his biggest uphill battles. The one thing that stuck out to me when I was going back and looking at his game logs, Matt, was there was 10 games where he shot under 35%. All 10 of those games came in conference play, and 9 out of those 10 games came in the last 2 months of play. So there was a couple people who had asked me, you know, you said that teams were figuring out how Trae Young was playing and how to guard him on defense. Well, there's your proof right there. It's not everything, but there's some solid proof that teams were figuring out how to play, and when he wasn't knocking down shots, it was careless at times. So there is a mixed bag with Trae Young, but any of that I just said, do you think you could bring to the Bulls and say it's either positive or, hey, this isn't going to work out here, especially with maybe guys like Chris Dunn and Zach LaVine?
Well, I mean, like, the idea of pairing Young with Dunn makes sense in that if you wanted to play them on the court simultaneously, the Bulls love Dunn's defense, but Dunn can't shoot. You know, we're crossing our fingers and hoping that Dunn has spent some time working on his three ball in the offseason and becomes at least a semi-reliable three-point threat. But right now, he's just not. So if you put Trae Young in the backcourt with him, all of a sudden the Bulls' backcourt has a three-point shooter in it, which, and you know, Zach LaVine, as a starting two guard for the small amount of time we've seen him and through also his years in Minnesota, he's not afraid to take the three, but it's not the most lethal part of his game. So in that sense, the strengths of Trae Young make sense hypothetically if the Bulls are okay with pairing him next to Dunn in the front court and pushing Zach LaVine to small forward. The weaknesses are there, and they're glaring, and you mentioned the fact that some of his worst games came against conference opponents, came late in the season as defenses kind of started to figure him out. You could also make the argument that there wasn't a whole lot of other talent offensively on that Oklahoma team, so if they were keying in on Trae Young, they stopped Trae Young. In an ideal world, the Bulls can have in Trae Young, just like for the fun of it, let's make the Steph Curry comparison. The Warriors were a two-dimensional team for the most part with Steph and Klay before they added KD. And so if defenses were keying in on Steph, they could make things difficult for him and for the Warriors. Well, you can't really spend most of your time and effort defensively keying in on Steph when you have Kevin Durant on your team, because he's probably right now the second best ISO player in the game, the second best scorer in the game, maybe the best scorer in the game. So Trae Young is Steph Curry. Zach LaVine, Klay Thompson. Lauri Markkanen turns into one of the most dominant, you know, stretch fours in the game and is there for Kevin Durant for the sake of this comparison. In that scenario, in that world, having Trae as an offensive weapon on the Bulls doesn't necessarily mean the danger and doom of him being minimalized in his one season at Oklahoma because you have other scorers around him. That's basically what the problem is. Trae Young could be a great scorer and a great three-point threat in the NBA if he has other people around him who can score and create their own shots. Trae Young was the only one on that Oklahoma team who could create his own shot, and that's, I think, why you saw him struggle as the season progressed. So in that ideal scenario, he does make sense. And I think he makes more sense for the Bulls than Sexton did because he is a much better shooter than Sexton. And what are the Bulls going to play Dunn and Sexton together and have two guys in their backcourt who can't shoot? Doesn't make sense to me.
The one thing that I'll say, too, if the Bulls were to draft Trae Young, I'm curious to see whether or not Trae Young can thrive playing off the ball, because for the most part, he was commanding at Oklahoma at a high level. And to me, it doesn't make any sense to play Chris Dunn off ball because he's not a shooter. And so to me, that's where I think things get mixed up. And then talking about the fact that you would have to push Zach LaVine all the way down to the three and have him guard some of the best talent in the NBA, I don't have enough faith right now that there are enough guys on this Bulls team that can catch and shoot and maybe do things that Trae Young can help with, like as far as his assists go. I was looking at, just talking about those games that he shot under 35% in, and most of them came with losses. 7 out of those 10 were losses, but Trae Young stacked up near double digits in every one of those games as far as assists go. So I think I'm looking at it in terms of, if you draft this guy and you want him to contribute right away, you need guys that can be catch and shoot players, and the only one that you have so far is Lauri Markkanen. Zach LaVine has shown that his offensive ability, for the most part right now, from the 25 games that we saw, was being able to score with the ball in his hands. Off ball was a lot harder for him and not as productive. So to me, same thing goes with Chris Dunn. What do you do with him? Are you going to try and get Trae Young to play off the ball and more so like a Klay Thompson style? I just don't think that works. And Chris Dunn, like you had said, not a great jump shooter either. So to me, there's a lot of holes that don't make sense when you're talking about putting Trae Young on this team. Look, his offensive game, and if it flourishes in any way, can be amazing. And I think the one thing that strikes me, and I think I got you have getting a little bit more aggravated as time has passed, is the unfair comparisons that Trae Young's getting to Steph Curry. I think that's a lot of pressure on this guy to come in the league and have to live up to those expectations. Now, granted, he might have a microscope on him depending on where he goes, but I think the best fit for him is going to be somebody that he can command the ball with, and he's got somebody next to him, maybe at the two, that's a catch and jump shooter, a guy that can help spread his game out from the three. Look, I like Trae Young's ceiling as far as an offensive player, but the fit in terms of where this team goes if they do take Trae Young, I think puts a lot of question marks on Chris Dunn and whether or not the Bulls really think that he's going to be the point guard of the future here. And that maybe even goes the same thing with Colin Sexton. If they are really intrigued about Colin Sexton, I think the same question is brought up, whether or not they feel like Chris Dunn is the point guard of the future here, or they're going to look to trade him.
Which then, of course, I can hear all sorts of angry Bulls fans already just by the thought of, well, maybe they aren't all that high on Chris Dunn, and they would they've decided that they would rather roll the dice with one of these two young point guards in this draft and give them significant minutes in their rookie season and try playing them on the court with Chris Dunn, try playing them separately, have the whichever rookie point guard they draft run their second unit, step aside campaign, and go from there. But, I mean, can you imagine the backlash from the fan base if one of the main pieces that they got in the Jimmy Butler trade is a guy that they turn around and trade away a season and a half after the Butler trade goes down?
I know, and I think there would be a lot of backlash is if there isn't other moves in place. So if we're talking about Trae Young being drafted at 7, I would hope that there is other moves in place, whether the Bulls are going to try to move up from 22 and take a more surefire guy that they can stick and play ready at the three alongside Chris Dunn and Zach LaVine, or if they're going to move on from Chris Dunn and figure out whether or not they can get another value piece as far as future picks or another talent that they see fit better and let Trae Young play right away and start as the point guard for this Bulls team. I think you brought up a fascinating point too, is if they do take Trae Young and they keep Chris Dunn on this roster, letting him maybe come off with that second unit. The one thing that I pointed out too when I was watching Trey Young's game, just looking over his stats, his usage rate for Oklahoma was at 40%. 40% usage rate, which I think
that's
is
insane.
Absolutely nuts.
That's like Russell Westbrook levels of usage percentage.
Seriously. And so my thought here was, okay, there's a lot of scrutiny. We gave him a lot of scrutiny for maybe games where he was going like 17 for 39. The one game that sticks out is when he had 48 points, but he had that on 39 shots. A usage rate, which I feel like if he was inserted into this Bulls roster, that usage rate's coming down, way down. And maybe that makes him more of a productive player, not only passing the ball, but his shot selection more productive. So I'm a little bit watching Trae Young's game and watching his film and going through his strengths and weaknesses. I can take a little bit of a sigh of relief if the Bulls are in fact interested, but look, there's other pieces that I think the Bulls can take and work on outside of the point guard position that I'd like to see them do. But this report about him and also Colin Sexton at the same time, what do you make of that? Outside of Trae Young, what do you make of Colin Sexton?
Well, yeah, so I was going to say, well, you know, and I touched on Sexton a bit earlier. He has better, you know, end-to-end speed than Trae Young. For Fred Hoiberg's offense, where you're trying to push the pace, Colin Sexton can push the pace like no other. We saw that all season long. We saw it in Bama's conference tournament. We saw it several times. The dude is crazy fast, and he attacks the rim, and he's a better finisher at the rim right now than Colin Sexton than Trae Young is. He's longer, he's taller, he's stronger. But he is not the shooter that Trae Young is. So that's how I feel about Sexton. And to me, pairing him with Chris Dunn makes absolutely zero sense. Like, none. But to your question about this report, if we can go back to that for a minute, the fact that the Bulls are saying, or at least, you know, saying to Goodwill and presumably everybody that's there at the Advocate Center for Bulls media is that, yeah, we're... I think to me, it sounded like a reminder from John Paxson that, hey, we're going to take the player that we think is the best player available at that seventh pick, even if it's a point guard. Doesn't say anything about how we feel about Chris Dunn, but if we're going to take the best player available. And so the fact that the point guard right now, and the way that people are valuing Trae Young and Sexton as kind of like back at middle of the lottery guys, presumably maybe on the fringe of top 10, where the Bulls are, that's the best example that Paxson can use to say, hey, this might be a position that you think we have figured out, but if the point guard, if either of these young point guards is the guy that we think is the best player at seven, we'll take him. Simultaneously, so that is Paxson saying, whoever it is we end up picking, look, I hedged my bets, and I told you all we were taking the best player available. The other possibility, and this is something that we talked about last week too, could be a smokescreen from the Bulls. Could be a smokescreen from the Bulls saying, wow, we really love both of these young point guards, in the hopes that two teams ahead of them take those two point guards.
I know, I thought about the same thing, too. I'm like, all right, well, this could just be saying, hey, you know what? If you guys do like Michael Porter Jr., you're flirting with some of these other guys, fine. Like, that's okay. Like, we are fine with Colin Sexton or Trae Young.
All they need to do is convince at least one team ahead of them to take one of those two point guards for themselves to maybe get a chance at Mo Bamba at seven or Michael Porter Jr. at seven and move from there. If they can, if this is a smokescreen, all they need to do is convince one team above them to take a point guard. And I mean, you know, we talked about that last week. I don't think that there's a whole lot that works with these smokescreens and various mind games that front offices leak specific information, quote unquote leak, to the media that's covering their team coming up to a draft. Oh, we really like this guy. We like this guy. We're worried about this guy. I don't think it really does anything, but even still, doesn't mean they won't try.
I've got two things for you before we wrap up here. I'll start with Colin Sexton real quick. Just want to highlight some of his strengths and weaknesses to his game. Watching over his film again, I found a lot of comparisons to not only De'Aaron Fox, but to what Chris Dunn is right now. And his explosiveness as a point guard to get off to run in space, I think is phenomenal. His isolation play is fantastic. And obviously I'm talking about this specifically in college. Like, some of these were sort of red flashing lights to me in terms of why would the Bulls want this guy. But let me continue. he's a high intensity player. Some of the work, especially as a lockdown defender, is what I think he's going to strive for in the NBA. And at times he looks really good, but at other times he looks disinterested. Finishing at the rim, too, I think his ability and his fearlessness to try and drive and finish at the rim is fantastic. He draws fouls a ton, which you want to see out of a point guard. And he shot nearly 80% from the free throw line, attempting about 8 free throws a game. So if you're looking at a point guard, a guy that's going to bang bodies down low, I think he's got the athleticism to do that. He's got the frame to do that as well, and the ability to draw fouls, I think, especially at the college level, shooting almost 8 free throws a game, I think is fantastic. And then he's also a winner too. Think about it. Let's go back to the Texas A&M game real quick. He had to make that shot coming down with 5 seconds left. He goes one end of the floor to the other, lays it up for a game winner, and that ended up sending Alabama to the NCAA tournament. So he is a winner. There are a couple things that I was struggling to understand how he fits with the Bulls. One being, I don't know where you put him next to Chris Dunn if Chris Dunn is going to stay on this roster. If the Bulls take Colin Sexton at number 7, that to me immediately says Chris Dunn, they're not interested. They're going to look to trade him, because to me, they're the same type of player you're trying to develop. Chris Dunn and Colin Sexton right now aren't great shooters. Colin Sexton especially, from long range, and his pull-up game isn't that great either. So to me, you got to pick between one of these two guys. So if the Bulls do take Colin Sexton at number 7, it throws a lot of red flags at me, saying, you know what, I don't think Chris Dunn's really going to be the point guard of the future, and maybe they look to trade him. Colin Sexton's game is great, but I think there are some huge weaknesses. He's lackadaisical on defense at times. Catch and shoot too, and especially when he's wide open, he's got shots wide open. He's missed a ton when he was on Alabama. So those are just a couple things that scare me about his game, and I think his drove his draft stock down a little bit, and that's why you see him anywhere between 9 and 14 on draft boards.
I think if the Bulls actually are as quote-unquote enamored with either of these two point guards as they claim to be, my gut feeling is that they're higher on Trae Young just because of the insane shooting potential, which obviously Fred Hoiberg would love, and they would feel okay about, no, we actually do want to keep Chris Dunn, and we want to play these guys together, and we think Dunn can compensate for Trae Young's lack of length and defensive skill, and we can play either of them on the ball and either of them off the ball at any given time to try to find the best looks for the other scorers on the floor, Zach LaVine, Markkanen. But you need to add that shooting threat to your backcourt, because right now your backcourt doesn't really have it. So that's why I would think, if pressed, that they would see Trae Young as a better fit than Colin Sexton. And I think even just across the board among all people at draft scouts, Trae Young is being valued higher than Sexton just because he has that Steph Curry comparison. Realistic or not, fair or not, we all saw him shoot the lights out in several nationally televised games all season long. So I think that's why Trae Young has the edge, and I think that's why Bulls front office would probably be leaning to Young over Sexton if they are, in fact, interested at all in taking a point guard.
Last thing before we get out of here, Matt. So I represented the Bulls on Salt Lake City ESPN 700 on Friday, and I got to share this with Bulls fans, because
did they ask you about the Bulls signing Jabari Parker this offseason?
No. But there was a very interesting pick. So they asked one person that covers the team from all 30 teams to come on and make their draft selection. So I was sent the draft selection about 12 hours before I went on air. And guess who the Kings took? Guess who the guy that said that if they were drafting at number 2, which they are, still are, they weren't moving anywhere, they were going to take this guy at number 2. Who do you think it is?
Trae Young?
Close.
Michael Sexton?
Michael Porter Jr. at number 2.
At 2? Wow.
Mohamed Bamba was still there at 7. So I made that selection. I said that if Mohamed Bamba is there at 7, without a doubt, no questions asked, I'm taking him at number 7. I was very surprised that I didn't get to hear the reasoning behind why he took Michael Porter Jr. at number 2. But talk about front offices that make weird moves. The Kings are one of them, And Orlando is another one that could potentially be very volatile. It's a lot of teams in the top six that front offices haven't had the best of luck, especially of recently. So there could be some volatility there, but I was very shocked that somebody surrounded by the Kings and covers the Kings said that they would take Michael Porter Jr. at number two, should it be their selection. So I just wanted to share that with Bulls fans.
I mean, yeah, it is. I guess it is kind of crazy to hear that, just because for the most part, our general consensus across the board is that Michael Porter Jr. is not going top four. It's going to be Ayton and Bagley and Jaren Jackson Jr. and Doncic thrown in there somewhere. That being said, Porter Jr. was still the number one prospect a year ago. Coming out of high school, Michael Porter Jr. was hands down. Everybody said this is going to be the best kid in the 2018 draft. This is going to be the pick in the 2018 draft. Because of the back surgery and missing most of his one-and-done season, that is no longer the narrative. But if a team desperate for a star player, a franchise-changing player, is willing to take the risk and say, okay, yeah, Bagley, maybe you're going to have a nice NBA career. Doncic, you're more of a question mark. Jaren Jackson Jr., cool, great stretch big for the NBA. But none of those guys have the scoring superstar potential that everybody was slapping on Michael Porter Jr. a year ago. If a team is willing to take the risk, I wouldn't be surprised to see him somehow shock, quote unquote, everybody and become a top three pick. If a team is willing to take the risk, he is still the guy that everybody believed was going to be the best offensive talent in this draft. And do you pass on that guy just because of a back?
I mean, I'm giving Bulls some of the Bulls fans out there who do want Michael Porter Jr. to be in a Bulls uniform a mini heart attack, and I don't mean to do that, but just realistic sense, because I didn't hear the explanation of why he took Michael Porter Jr. just from a short shot looking at it. They've got Buddy Hield as a shooting guard. They've got their starting point guard in De'Aaron Fox. Willie Cauley-Stein looks like their big man of the future and can develop. And they've got a couple other big guys, too, that are still young, developing prospects. So really, their only hole is really to look at sort of that wing position where Michael Porter can play, you know, the three or the four. So that would be, in just a little bit of a snapshot at looking at what the Kings might do, that would be my reasoning why they would take Michael Porter Jr. And like you said, if medicals check out, he still, I think, has one of the highest upsides, if not the highest upside of any of these players in this draft. I think the medicals still are just the biggest question mark. And I think the inability to see him play fully, I think, wears on a lot of people, and they tend to forget. And that happens. That happens with NBA prospects going into the draft all the time. So I think that's what I was looking at more so with the Kings, though, because they've already got their starting shooting guard of the future, their point guard, they're one of their big men in their front court. It makes me think that, if they can't find a trading partner to move down and take a guy at that wing position, then maybe they'll just shoot for the moon and take the guy at number two who they really like.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I wouldn't be shocked if the Kings did something like that. They are the Kings, after all. Like, you never know what the hell they're gonna do.
It's so true. Well, that's gonna about do it here on Locked On Bulls. Remember, if you want to interact with the show, 331-979-1369 is our text line and our voicemail line, so call that number. Leave us a voicemail. Any of your thoughts, anything that we talked about late last week or on this episode today, anything for mailbag, send it over there at 331-979-1369. You can follow us on social media at Jordan C. Malley, at Bulls_Peck, and at Locked On Bulls. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/LockedOnShyBulls, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and anywhere you find podcasts, you will find us. Dash Radio, DashRadio.com, and the Dash Radio app on the Nothing But Net channel. We're live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time. That's tomorrow morning, Dash Radio, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time on the Nothing But Net channel. For Matt Peck, for Jordan Malley, have a wonderful day, Bulls Nation. Be back tomorrow with a fresh episode. For Jordan and Matt, we are out. Deuces.
Locked On Bulls, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA. Locked On Bulls is live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central. For more content and to stay up to date, head over to LockedOnBulls.com, part of FanRag Sports.